Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and today we'll be talking about Solaris and Synapse FI disintermediating bank services to help you run your own virtual bank. HSBC's efforts to create a new hip, high-tech digital brand, Interstellar, the new combination between Chain and Lightyear Corporation, and Alipay and WeChat focus on the finance side of the FinTech equation. Please hit subscribe to keep up to date with this and all the latest FinTech news. So, starting with our first story is a little correction from our podcast from last week.
So Bloomberg a few weeks ago reported that Goldman Sachs was going to cease their efforts to create a Bitcoin derivative trading desk. But news came out sometime earlier this week that actually that was fake news. The company has no intentions to stop their efforts, and they are in fact going to go ahead with the plan. So like Bank Innovation and Bloomberg and many others reported it, we fell prey to fake news. And
I might take this opportunity to dispute that this is fake news. I would call it human error. And I'm glad that we, as well as Bloomberg and Bank Innovation, have taken pains to correct it.
Right. I actually call it fake news because that's what Marty Chavez called it. He said, you know, he hated to use the term, but actually said that it was fake news. So
I'm rolling my eyes.
Well, we do try to get it right every time here, but well, Goldman, they're still creating a lot of back-end services for being able to trade and hold and do custodial services for blockchain currencies. So they haven't changed their whole direction on that, right?
Correct. I think they're still doing that.
Oh, so it's the same thing. It was just taking it out of context. And, you know, that sounds like so much of what's happened with the cryptocurrency market. Is any bit of rumor or, you know, someone trying to guess at what's going to happen sends the market, you know, crazy in one direction or the other. I saw that the Bitcoin did drop. I mean, it's been dropping anyway, but it dropped in connection with this story, the initial story.
Right. I have no evidence to back this up, but my impression is that Bitcoin and cryptos are in general more susceptible to social media stuff than any other kind of trading mechanism.
Which we're not advocating, by the way. So, So it's very sensitive, and we'll get into some of that a little bit later, actually. So for our first story, I'm going to get into a very interesting area, actually. So, Monica, if you wanted to offer your very own credit card and checking accounts, you could do that without getting a bank license.
Tell me more, John.
Yeah, so if you want the Monica card, you can go to either Solaris or Synapse FI, and they offer services so that you could attach banking services to your current offerings or create your own virtual bank by putting together the pieces of what they offer.
How does this offering differ from what you can get nowadays with a Utah chartered bank like WebBank and other players that basically partner with fintechs to offer the services that you need to offer, that you need to have a banking license for? So why go with this company instead of like a traditional sort of virtual online only chartered bank in the U.S.?
Well, these are banks that are set up exclusively to offer financial services. So they're not a bank with branches or anything like that. They're set up just to have the technology, the APIs, and all the compliance designed around having a partner and offering this as a service. So you could go online right now to Solaris, actually, and enter the products that you want to offer, what your goals are, and start setting up the connection with them, and they just handle the back end for you. And that's their only business model. That's the only thing they do.
And is the thinking, so it's almost like white-labeled banking.
Yeah, right. Exactly, and right. Components too. So you could take any part of a bank service that they're offering, and they're adding more and more services, but the main ones, checking, debit cards, credit cards, that sort of thing.
So who is their ideal target customer? Is it an existing business that is wanting to create some brand loyalty and additional penetration with their customer base? Is it somebody who just hey, it's Monica, and I want the Monica card. So here I come, Solaris.
Yeah, well, it's any combination. So you can create a virtual bank and take the whole suite of their products, presumably maybe until you get set up on your own or you know, it's a big component that you're missing at your small financial institution. You can scale rapidly, kind of like having the web Amazon services, right? You can scale huge in very, very quickly because you have this back end that you didn't have to build up on your own. And they take care of the regulatory and compliance side of it as well. They have the banking license, and so that you don't have to.
So what's most interesting to me about this is the fact that Solaris will handle the regulatory and compliance issues for you. Because here we are on, I believe, the 10-year anniversary of the beginning of the great financial recession. And one of the things that you read in a lot of the kind of where are we now is that, yes, banks are better capitalized, but also the big banks have even more market share than they used to. And so this actually sounds like a way where you might actually be in a position for smaller entities to come up and grab some market share away from the big banks.
Well, yeah, that's true. At least in the U.S., there's thousands and thousands of less banks than there were 30 years ago. I'm sure it's like 25%, something like that, of the banks that there were. And so it's consolidated hugely. So you can have a Monica bank, Monica credit card, Monica debit cards, Monica custodial services, all fully regulatory compliant, overnight. You just have to do all the marketing.
Love it. They're basically selling shovels and pickle and
pickles. That's right.
They're selling pickles. Yeah.
Nothing sells better than shovels and pickles.
It's a winning combination. Yeah.
And on the lending side, you can set whatever parameters that you want as well. So if you want to be a subprime lender, you can do that. And or if you want to target specific borrowers, you can do that through their products. It's very customizable.
These do seem like some interesting firms to watch and see kind of who their customer base turns out to be, and then by extension, kind of the companies that use their infrastructure, how big do their customer bases become?
Yeah, it almost strikes me as a EU-based sort of model like we have in the US with WebBank, which apparently is a partner for LendingClub, Prosper, PayPal, and numerous other fintech players. So this could maybe spur the European market in fintech to kind of expand a bit more.
All right. If you want to start your own bank, the links to these articles are on our show notes. Now, next up is HSBC, their efforts to keep up with all these innovative new fintech companies.
Yeah, so kind of an interesting report in Telegraph last week detailing HSBC's plan to basically become more digitally savvy by creating an internal digital first bank. So they call this project Project Iceberg because they want to see this as a way to sink new competition from online upstarts.
Oh, I thought it was they're trying to avoid hitting an iceberg.
No, I think they're
the Titanic.
Yeah, no, I think they want to be the iceberg, not the Titanic,
and want to make that makes sense.
The fintech up the other players are the Titanic. But yeah, they basically it's kind of a secret project now, but they've hired about 100 people or so to work on this stuff. They say that it'll be more competitive rates than their mainstream HSBC brand. And the one that launched it as early as this year in beta mode. So this is sort of one of the many things that we've seen across all the banks. So we have, of course, BBVA investing in multiple startups. We have Santander and RBS, of course, doing a lot of work in the field. So it seems like the new play from the big players is to create your own bank to see whether you can stave off competition.
So 100 people doesn't seem like that many.
That's a medium-sized startup, right?
But for something like something as huge as HSBC,
compared to one of the biggest banks in the world, 100 jobs isn't very much.
Yeah, it's not a lot. Yeah, but I think it's a good testament to the fact that they're maybe willing to cannibalize their own core business.
I would dispute that. I think 100 person hire, that's not even close to cannibalizing any part of HSBC's current business. And when they start getting to thousands of employees and they really are making the very difficult decisions around profitability and resource management to keep this effort alive at the expense of their traditional business, then I'll be interested.
Yeah, that's the tricky thing. It's very much, the story sounds a lot like disruptive technology, you know, the old Clayton Christensen Innovator's Dilemma book, where, you know, the incumbents just can't make the painful, you know, cannibalizing. Yeah, exactly.
You can't kill everybody. Yeah.
Can't, you know, suffer the cannibalization in order to grow into the new market. You know, that's the whole point of the disruptive technology, is that the new players aren't as good and they don't offer the full range that the current player has, but they're just good enough to start, you know, picking away at the existing player.
And when you're a publicly traded company, you also have to face the dynamics of the growth trajectory that your newest child may have is compared to the scale of your legacy business, it's just not going to make up, most likely, for whatever part of your business you're sacrificing.
The quarterly reporting and the analyst questions are all the wrong kinds of incentives for building something that, you know, can lose money and, you know, is not going to the bottom line every quarter for the analyst to see. And so, yeah, it's a, you know, that's one of the reasons, the bureaucracy, the internal power struggles, the politics, you know, the naysaying by existing executives. I mean, there's just so much against, and that's what creates the whole innovator's dilemma.
But yet we see this sort of happen across a lot of banks. I know that, for example, JP Morgan has Finn, which is competing against their lower end sort of checking accounts. Wells Fargo announced they're going to release something called Greenhouse as well. So I think there is a movement towards that. I just, to your point, I wonder whether this actually will threaten their core business. My guess is maybe not.
That's the real test, right?
That's the real test, right? I don't fault any of these companies for doing it. I completely understand, right? You'd rather build up some of this expertise, try some of these new technologies out on your own than let it all shake out in the marketplace and miss every bit of it.
Miss the boat, yeah.
But at the same time, it's very easy at this stage to kind of have these very small brands with relatively small footprints and certainly relatively small employee counts. But will you really give it the love that it needs to take off when the love that it needs to take off really hurts some of the rest of your business?
Love hurts.
It kind of reminds me of the GM Saturn, the new hip, you know, innovative, starting from scratch type of a brand.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, that worked out well, and we all drive Saturns today.
And part of the thing that was different about Saturn was they had a very different dealership model and sales model.
No haggle.
Right.
That's right.
And that's a scary and hard thing in a business that's got its whole reputation.
We all love car salesmen, yeah.
Infamy.
Yeah. So this, I don't mean to sound like a downer, but I'm suspicious.
Good luck, HSBC. You'll need it.
Better stick to money laundering.
Oh, man.
Low blow?
Low blow.
World-class regulatory and compliance efforts. Yeah. So, speaking of new efforts, Interstellar is a combination of two fintech companies. What are they up to?
Well, so the Wall Street Journal reported this week that Chain and Lightyear, both companies that have been using blockchain technology, they're combining into a company that they're calling Interstellar, which we have agreed here on the podcast is a pretty sweet name and a fairly good movie. So what's interesting here is that we are seeing some consolidation in this space, which I think is always to be expected in a market that's hitting any kind of maturity. But also, some of the comments that the folks behind these companies mentioned are that this is really a sign that kind of getting companies to really plug into Bitcoin and cryptocurrency technology, it's a little harder than they expected. Chain has been around for 4 years, and they've actually had a partnership with NASDAQ since 2015 to build blockchain-based trading platforms. And you know, the CEO of Chain said that customers were just really never completely comfortable with the idea of running their own blockchain network. Can't say that I blame them. So he's actually quoted as saying, "We hit a wall a little more than a year ago with respect to our customers' willingness to take the ultimate step, launching and operating a network of their own. So since they were finding that their customers would rather use a decentralized network that they don't have to maintain or operate or own, that is one of the things that the combined Interstellar is going to focus on. So how can they keep Stellar's open platform and leverage whatever specifications and kind of business cases that their customers, such as NASDAQ and Visa, would want to use? So
they're a commercial, like a back-end offering, these two companies?
Yes. And I think what's interesting here is that, I mean, would it really have taken you 4 years to figure out that customers don't want to manage their own blockchain networks?
Maybe they have the funding, they have the runway to do it, not test the market, and just kind of came to see the light eventually. But
yeah, it just seems to me that this is a natural step. And an interesting consolidation effort.
I wonder whether this will presage sort of more consolidation, because we see a lot of sort of players doing very niche stuff with blockchain now.
Mm-hmm.
And I could definitely see this becoming more of a trend now, people sort of combining forces and having a more robust product offering, as opposed to these very niche kind of things they do nowadays.
Yeah.
Well, it does kind of remind me a little bit of the dot-com bust. I guess it was, where people would say, oh, it's like tying two stones together and seeing if it'll float. You know, if it's not working, it's not working, no matter what you do.
Well, but this even comes back to like the Solaris and the Synapse conversation, right? Those companies are going to be more powerful the more offerings they have to offer their customers. So the more it feels like a one-stop shop to solve a lot of your business or technology problems, I think that's a really compelling thing for businesses of all kinds, right? Who's going to be like the Salesforce equivalent of fintech services?
Right.
Who knows?
Maybe Salesforce.
I'm sure they'd be down.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I saw they're using the Stellar blockchain. And, I was curious, why they chose Stellar. It seems like they're promoting as part of their mission to promote Stellar blockchain. So that's interesting that hopefully Chain and Lightyear will find their niche and offer some interesting products. I always
don't
like to see
Interstellar.
Interstellar, right.
Yes, will offer some interesting products and save Stellar from collapse or whatever. So who knows which of these will be the survivors. You're right. On to the exciting portion of the podcast, court cases.
Ooh, baby.
Oh, I know. I get that reaction a lot. Mm. Yeah. So there was a court case against someone who had been perpetrating fraud, some fraudulent issuances of blockchain currency.
This guy is so fascinating. He's such a great character.
Aren't they, though?
They always are, yeah.
So this guy apparently swindled people for about $300,000 worth.
Which, by the way, seems like small potatoes in the ICO world, right?
Yes,
that's not
so
that
too.
Much money. It seems like
it doesn't seem a lot to not get away with, you know?
Right,
yeah.
Right.
There's a lot of houses in the Hamptons and Connecticut that are from people who have swindled much, much more and
exactly.
Gotten away with
it.
So.
I read a report.
It's the little guys get caught.
It's the minnows, yeah. I read a report that apparently 78% of all ICOs are fraudulent. Just nothing ever comes out of it. So this seems like, again, a very small number for that.
Well, that's true. But what makes this case interesting is that the U.S. District Judge, Raymond Deary, in this case, said that these cryptocurrencies should be treated or could be treated for enforcement purposes by the SEC as securities. And so in explaining his reasoning, he wasn't able to mention any prior court decisions. He wasn't able to cite any prior cases, just showing how new this whole area is and how people are, you know, all the regulators and the legal system have to make things up as they go along.
So basically the ICOs now are operating sort of in this weird gray space where they're not legal tender, but they can be considered securities. And if you do something with it, you may get your ass in jail.
Basically, calling yourself a currency and then acting out with fraud does not protect you, is what this judge has said.
From the SEC and FINRA and all the other places.
Yeah, yeah. He said it must be interpreted flexibly in order to, like you said, protect in this case. And this kind of points out that cryptocurrencies, instead of avoiding the man and the government and regulations and being its own world might be getting crushed by being considered a commodity by the CFTC, by being considered a security by the SEC, and Congress hasn't passed any laws yet defining what any of these cryptocurrencies or blockchain-related assets should, how they should be treated. So instead of avoiding everybody, they're getting piled on, dogpiled on by every regulator, you know, as an abundance of caution, right, to avoid fraud and to avoid all the things, all the bad things that, like this, that could happen.
So I know that, are we aware of any efforts to actually classify cryptocurrencies as their own asset class or whatever, so that you have a regular body? No. It's still sort of all...
Well, that's... So Congress it should be the one that passes a law, and they haven't done this yet.
And they...
So at least, so all the regulators have been saying, you know, since there's an overlap with commodities, and that's CFTC, there's overlap with stocks and other securities, they get regulated by that. So they might get the worst of both worlds instead of being off on their own and being the free, you know...
Free to be you and me and avoid the tax man dream.
Yeah, yeah. So an interesting case. So if you do think you're going to go off the grid, even if you are in cold storage, you might have another thing coming when the judge slams down his gavel. So let's talk about some of the bigger players. Let's go back to the giants.
The Economist had an article out this week about Alipay and WeChat and how they are consciously trying to de-emphasize the fin and emphasize the tech. And in fact, some other things have been in the news just briefly here. Jack Ma, the founder of Alipay.
The soon-to-be-retired founder of Alipay.
Just announced that he will be retiring in a year. And he was also quoted as saying, FinTech is passé. The hot new thing is TechFin. So aside from my deep desire to work in TechFin into as much of our future podcasts as I can, mainly to annoy my co-hosts, I thought that was probably some good regulatory management on the part of Jack Ma. Back in 2008, Jack Ma was quoted as saying, if the banks don't change, we will change the banks. So there's a research firm that The Economist quotes that estimates that China's fintech firms will take more than 40% of its potential payment card fees by 2020, which is, you know, very close.
So they're going to totally eat into the incumbents there.
Very much so. That would be an annual loss of about $60 billion for China's banks. So when you're looking at this regulatory landscape where banks in China, many of them are very well connected, if not basically owned and operated by the state, you're seeing this huge potential revenue loss come through. And Ant and WeChat have gotten really big, which we've spoken about before, but I will give you some numbers here for context today. Ant is estimated to be worth about $150 billion. That's just a little bit less than HSBC, whom we were just piling on in an earlier segment here. So it's already one of the world's most valuable financial firms. And WeChat is owned by Tencent. Tencent Holdings has a $400 billion market cap. And a lot of that comes from gaming. It doesn't all come from the banking side of things, but from on a size basis, that's
still massive, yeah.
It's not far behind Berkshire Hathaway. So it's that
that's
kind
incredible.
Of massive.
Yeah.
And if nothing else changed, they would only grow even bigger, just even in their own domestic markets. So China has to kind of consider, the government needs to consider, kind of who do they want to play more ball with? Who do they want to make life a little harder for? In this context, mobile transactions in China, which WeChat and Alipay by
are the leaders,
far
yeah, right.
make up most of it, The total value of those exceeded $18 trillion last year. So it's grown 100 times more since 2013. So in 4 years, it's gotten that big. And also, that exceeds the total volume transaction of everything that MasterCard and Visa did last year as well.
That's incredible. So going back to the sort of the tech fin part of this,
mm-hmm.
how exactly will Jack Ma and Alipay and all these other sort of emerging fintechs focus on the tech part of fintech?
Such a good question. So some of these things these firms have done to kind of to get ahead of this, and some of the things the government has done to them. So we've talked before about Yue Bao, leftover treasure, kind of Alipay's money market fund. Alipay capped the amount of cash that their users can invest or withdraw in a day. So they basically did that to themselves to kind of minimize some of their, hey, look how good we're doing. Look how much money we have.
Eye of Beijing shall not be cast upon us.
Yeah. And their online banks, which is WeBank when you're talking about Tencent's offering, mm-hmm. and MyBank when you're talking about Ant Financial.
WeBank, MyBank.
They are subject to deposit caps that have been imposed on them. You may recall in an earlier discussion about these two firms, they were developing credit scores on individuals, and the central bank cracked down on them but did call off the trial. And instead, they were given the consolation prize of some stakes in Baihang, and I apologize if I am not pronouncing that correctly, and that is a state-owned credit rating system.
Mm.
So you are really looking at a number of different things happening here. There's also the launch of Nets Union, and this is a clearinghouse for online payments. This is something that's going to be affecting both traditional banks and online banks in China. And the kind of the consumer reason for it is that it will make mobile payments safer, but it's also basically going to act as kind of like this intermediary between fintech firms and the banks. And the thinking is that this will make it harder for Ant and Tencent to kind of push really hard with their fee bargaining. And there are also some analysts, one of whom is quoted by The Economist, who thinks that it's really just a matter of time before this same union, clearinghouse, Nets Union, is used to actually limit mobile transactions. They'll use it as a way to say, hey, we want to control money laundering, we want to protect the consumer, but really it's a back-ended way to protect the banks.
So the argument is that basically China has created this Nets Union here to widen the moat, if you will, of banks and sort of keep the new fintech players at bay in this very dynamic environment now.
You can interpret it that way, right? I don't know that we necessarily know all of the motivations that went into this, but it's certainly something to be thinking of. But what I was really drawn to in this article were really just some of the numbers about how absolutely massive these firms are. And it's not the first time that we've said it, but when you put it in the context of some of the household names that we're familiar with, Visa and MasterCard and, you know, everything that they touch, and they are truly global businesses, are getting dwarfed by what's happening in, you know, primarily in one country by these firms. It's pretty astounding. A couple of other things. So Alipay has 54% of the mobile payment market compared to Tencent's 40% inside China.
But who has that last 6%? That's what I want to know.
I want to know that too. And also what's interesting here is that while WeChat has more than 1 billion users, they don't have as much of the mobile payments market. So could be kind of interesting to watch. Alipay only has 520 million active users or so in China. The three of us, your hosts here, we just recently listened to a CB Insights webinar about Ant Financial, and this article echoes one of the key thrusts of that presentation as well, which is that Ant Financial has been really savvy about creating partnerships with firms and places that Chinese tourists go. So lots of financial firms and kind of tourist resources. Ant Financial has really made some inroads there, where it sounds like Tencent hasn't necessarily been quite as focused on capturing the tourism market. But certainly that's a very canny way for Alibaba to use existing travel as a way to fund its business expansion.
It's certainly a huge market. I know that the Chinese, I think, represent the biggest number of tourists come from China in the world. I think they also spend the most money, so It's a really canny play.
And
absolutely.
It's a very recent development, right?
Extremely
you know, 10
recent.
10 years
yeah.
ago, you did not have hundreds of thousands of Chinese people getting on planes and going all over the world.
Yeah.
You do now.
Yeah, I remember going to Europe maybe like 10 years ago or so and basically seeing no Chinese people. But now you see Chinese restaurants and QR codes everywhere, and sort of they're more catering to that segment. So yeah, this makes total sense.
Well, let's see which one of them will win, Alipay or WeChat. They're just slugging it out to the end.
I think they'll both win. Like, what's wrong?
Apparently.
What's wrong with
China's not big enough for the two of them. That's all I'm saying.
It's a duopoly, sure. Yeah. Everyone's a winner.
Someone's going to Thailand at the end of the day. Thanks for that, Monica. And now it's time for our final bite, where we take a look at a number and the interesting story behind it. Monica, why don't you start us off?
So I've actually got two numbers, which I know is kind of cheating. But we talked earlier about cryptocurrencies being regulated as or being treated as securities when it comes to securities law. This week in the news, we had our first settlements agreed to by the SEC against some crypto hedge funds that were caught doing wrong. And
Stop.
The numbers are 200K and 560K. And I picked these numbers mainly because I thought that they were notable because I, for one, am glad when the regulators step in early and often for for law breaking. So we got our first settlements this week.
Wow. Well, congratulations to you and
the SEC.
Yeah, go SEC.
Well, yeah, we do want to see a well-managed and honest market. So, especially when it's a new frontier and the Wild West, people tend to get a little greedy.
Mm-hmm. Who knew?
Yeah. Capitalists. Who knew? So my final bite is $191 billion. And this is an homage of the 10th anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers. And so we're going to, let's see if we're seeing the collapse of a new, not a financial crisis, but.
Please no.
But the continued drop in the cryptocurrency world. So $191 billion is the total market capitalization of all the cryptocurrencies, at least those that we know about. And if you want to know how much of a drop that is, that's only going back to the levels that they were, less than a year ago, since around November of 2017. So it hasn't collapsed to nothing. It was $190 billion just less than a year ago. Now, some cryptocurrencies have fared worse than others. Ethereum is now at a 16-month low. That one's been getting hit. And just recently, we're recording in early September, which is when Lehman Brothers collapsed about 10 years ago. And on September 4th, the total market capitalization was $239 billion. And now today, September 12th, it's 20% lower.
Jeez.
So just in the past week, we've lost 20% of the market cap in cryptocurrencies. Another interesting point is that Bitcoin is recovered some of its valuation dominance. So people track how much of the total cryptocurrency space is that Bitcoin or Ethereum represent. At one short period last year, Ethereum passed the capitalization of Bitcoin, and now it's well below. And Bitcoin is now 56.9%.
So
as of today.
That's where it's nice to have some name recognition, right? Because
yeah.
You have to assume that
the
that
total
might be
cap.
A big chunk of what's
right.
keeping Bitcoin.
Right. It's the one, sure. It's the original, sure, yeah.
It's the Coca-Cola of cryptocurrencies. And yeah, that's their highest percent of the total market cap since December 16th, 2017. It sounds like a familiar number. I think that's close to their $20,000 mark of
right.
the Bitcoin price. So that's my final bite, and let's see what happens next. Of course, we are not recommending any investments.
None of this constitutes investment advice.
Either long or short, so
please see a professional investment advisor.
Yeah.
Not us. Yeah, so thanks. So my number is $150 billion, which is a good way to end the podcast on a more up note. So that is a total number that fintech will contribute to African economies by 2022. Yeah, go fintech in Africa.
So is this kind of like jumping ahead to the cell phone kind of thing instead of landlines?
I think so. I mean, we saw that, of course, in the fact that M-Pesa seems to have been sort of taking a leap forward in East Africa with mobile payments and stuff. And apparently a lot of the companies in the space will contribute significantly to the continent's economy. By creating things like jobs and sort of cheaper way to transfer money, and by getting all those efficiencies in place with fintech, we could be looking at again $150 billion uptick in GDP by 2022, so just a few years.
All right. Well, that's thanks for ending us on an up note. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the FinTech Newscast. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email us at info@fintechnewscast.com. We include the links to all the articles that we reference in the show notes. And thanks for listening.
Until next week.
Bye for now.